This is Bill Jenkins, and we're interviewing Mr. Charles Hoag, Sr., specifically in regard to the steel strike of 37. Mr. Hoag, what part did you play in the steel strike of 37?
Well, the part I played it was, of course, the FFL and CIF, that is the Youngstown chapter, and then we weren't affiliated at that time. That was in, we didn't affiliate until 41. And, of course, anyway, in 37, when the strike came on, we, of course, first I better explain this to you. The building trade was absolutely opposed to the strike, you know, of the steelworkers. They weren't together, and I was condemned. Of course, I had whatever I knew, I kept away from the building trades. Although they were in the Labor Congress, United Labor Congress, and I was secretary. And what happened was, I took part in it when they didn't know anything about it, because when Owens came in from the mine workers, you know, John Lewis is the fellow that started. He was up in the Ohio Hotel, 1200, in that, and him and I worked together a great deal. And then I sued the men. Now, what happened was, first, we got together with to talk to counsel to stop the mayor from hiring the veterans of the war before that, and
the veterans as police,
guards, you know. And we had a meeting in the council chambers, and Ewing, I think his name, I can't think of his name, and he didn't recognize us. In other words, they met and adjourned right away, you know. Mm-hmm. So they got together, and they went up, and Marty Higgins was the secretary of the, SADAN, rather. And there we met on the West Federal Street, right across from the, where the Warner Theater is now. And they decided they would sue the mayor to stop him, you know. And Line 11 was his name. And so they had a meeting, and I found out that I was a plaintiff. I didn't know anything about it. Understand?
Yeah.
I didn't realize. Well, I said, well, why do I? I said, I own a little home. I said, well, I want, if we lose this case, then where am I going to be? I said, don't worry about that. So they had money. They gathered money, you know, put a fund to buy. And I said, okay, come on, let's go. I never backed down on anything. So we hired Bill Keneally, who's dead now. He had been in Youngstown. Well, he was raised here, and he had a case. He went to Cleveland. He had the, I know you wouldn't be knowing anything about this, Stacy Wells case. That's Tommy Wells and Stacy Wells. I was a millionaire, you know, case. And he left Youngstown, and he lost his shirt. He went to Cleveland. And then he came back into town, and they hired him for the plan, for the, so we, I sued the mayor. I might as well, I was a plaintiff. And they had a consul, or rather we met over in the in the courthouse. And we claim that they didn't need these x-ray men. I say we because I was, although I was a plaintiff. And we had it before Judge Jenkins. He's dead now. And what happened was, when he decided, we thought and felt that they didn't need him. Well, then the city attorney and the council came over, you know, and they were in the case too, you know. So Ray Thomas was the prosecuting attorney, and his mother, Vern, was, I don't know whether his assistant or what it was, but anyway, we came into the case, and they decided that there was trouble. That the mayor, you know, had trouble because I can remember that Jenkins said, you see those guards down there in front of the county jail, where it is now. Anybody knows there's trouble. So Jenkins, although he was a very good friend, you know, he decided that there was trouble, and of course, I had the case, and I wanted a lawsuit. You know, in other words, I don't know, it was, I mean, there was trouble, but they carried that along. Well, then we claimed under the charter that the mayor did not have the right. Council would have to give him the right to hire him, and I won on that end of it. But I lost on and said there was no trouble. Well, there was trouble. So what happened was we met at different times, and the thing went along, and the steel strike was over. And what happened? I get beyond myself. I found out about, the case was laid apart before that. I was ahead of my story. What happened was, I got word in the carpenter's hall that there was a case up. You know, the case was, it had been appealed. The city appealed the case, that was. And the case was up before the appellate court, and I didn't know nothing about it. You understand what I mean? In the meantime, Bill Keneally had died, and we understood from one, I understood a fellow named Welsh said that Leininger and those fellows were to take up the case. It was Leininger and I. He didn't know nothing about it. Well, what happened was, he didn't know anything about it, so what happened was I was called in on the case, and I only had, well, the next day was a trial, you know, an appellate trial. And I said, well, I went down to find out, you know, what it was about, and they said, well, it's on tomorrow. Well, I says, after all, I said, I don't know anything about this. Well, you better get busy on this thing. So I called up John Owens, and I told him the story. I said, well, after all, I said, I'm stuck in this thing. I have no idea. I was just learned today. Tomorrow was a trial. So he said, well, we'll take care of that. So what happened was the next day, there was a fellow came in from Pittsburgh, a lawyer. Siegel, his name was, and he was pretty sharp. But he knew more about the charter than what Ray Thomas did. Ray Thomas was, you know, Ray Thomas was the prosecuting attorney. He knew more about the city charter than me did. I was surprised at the knowledge, you know. So I, when I got through that day, they said to me, what about the case, you know? They decided, as I said, that that's the way it was done. There was trouble and so forth. And so, to settle it, they asked me if I ever talked to the judges, the three appellate judges, you know. There was Mr. Bennett, Mr. Warren, and Nichols from Clareton. They said they're meeting upstairs. You may go up there and talk to them. So I said, sure, I'll talk to them and find out what this is all about. So I went up there and they let me in, and I said, well, they said, we'll disqualify Bennett, because Bennett was a city attorney at the, just before that, before he got on there. And I said, no, you don't need to disqualify him, because him and I are very personal friends. And if he said I'm guilty, if I was on there and he said I was guilty, I'd take it because I know him. You know, I said, I know how honest he is. Well, they sat on that and they said, well, Charlie, the thing is over, everything's okay, you know. And Nichols had been with the miners for a high, you know, an attorney before that. So they said the strike is over and we might as well forget about it. And I said, well, okay. I said, as far as I'm concerned, I'm ready to, you know. So the city, I said, that was the appeal at Court of Appeals. So what happened was they said, we will wipe it out, and that's the way it was done. Now that was, during the strike, you're talking about activities. Now the activities we had, I was for the unionization
Let me ask you a question first to clarify something. You said you were Secretary of the United Labor Congress.
Right? In 37, became Secretary. Yes.
That's when you became Secretary. And you were from what?
Well,
what
the
union?
Letter carrier. The letter carrier. 85. We've been since 1917. Hmm. You know, a member of the AFL. Before that, of course, we wasn't. But I've always been in labor. You might as well say unionization, because although I didn't, and I joined up with the Labor Congress naturally, and I became secretary of it, and that was a split between the two trades. They dominated the Labor Congress, because the miscellaneous trades, such as the streetcar men and the, and we'd say the letter carriers and the retail clerks and so forth, they were the miscellaneous end of it, see. And of course the building trades dominated at that time. And finally the truck drivers, I reorganized the truck drivers two or three times. Anyway, they got together one time, and the carpenters didn't work with the building trades a lot, so they met down on East Meadow Street at the driver's hall, at the 300 square down there, and they decided they would elect their own officers, you know, that is this miscellaneous group. So I was selected for secretary, and I said, I can't do this because you meet the same night that the letter carriers meet. We met twice a month then. And I said, how can I be in? Well, I said, we'll ask the letter carriers to forego, you know. And they did. So I became secretary, and in the election, I thought I wouldn't win because, you know, they were other, but I don't know, I remember that night very well because I said, I'm not going to win, and the cardboard boy said, don't worry about that. So at the end of it, I was flown in, and I became secretary, and of course, the building trades, they, well, we worked together, and we always have been. I never drew lines, you know, of any kind. And
was that in January or February of 37?
Well, it was around in that time. I don't know just what month. I couldn't tell you. But anyway, it was before the steel strike anyway. Because what happened was I was for the unionization of the steel workers because I had worked in the mills in 1918, when I quit the post office because we were starving to death. There was very few of us left, you know what I mean. I worked down there, and I was there when the company representation plan came into existence. And I remember talking to them because I was safety inspector, and I go wherever, you know, all over the plant. And I remember well that I said, this here plan won't work because nobody in a department you can select him to carry your grievances to the, they met every week on a Thursday over on Poland Avenue. That's it. And I said, because he's working for the company too. Now he's not going to endanger himself for that. So the thing I would advise you to do is to get an outside union. Well, when the war was over in 18, November 11th, I was still down there, but 1919, the boys were coming back from across the pond, you know, the veterans, and they come back to the jobs that they had before they left, not like they're doing now. And I was moved, was moved, they wanted me to move over to the fire department, you know, down the street and two. I was moved, I said, okay, I moved over there. I had charge of the drinking water system, cleaning one thing and another, and I, of course, I could go into a lot of detail with that. And then finally, I don't know, it ended up where they started in this here company buying plan, you know, where you bought to the mill, you know, and they tried that. Well, I was working, I was put on to take orders, you know, up at the plate mill, I remember that well. But the men didn't go for it. You know, marriage. Then
what kind of things could they buy?
Well, anything they buy, but they buy it through the company, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was
their clothing and food. And
then they bought it through there. They could pay for it out of their pay, you know what I mean. And they bought shoes, whatever you had. It was like the old days of the mine workers. But anyway, they didn't go until they asked me I'd go back to the drinking water system. And I said, I'll tell you why I woke up back there. Because of the veterans got it, who had it before, and he's back here, and he's entitled to that. So I went over to the company office. I said, I'll take my chances, and I went over to the employment office, and a cousin of mine worked over there. And then Bill Whiting, and he had gone to Briar Hill. That was when they were by themselves. And I said, I'll take my chances. So I was in 1919. Well, then the strike came on in 1919, I'm going back beyond that, that I learned that you could be fired any day and you couldn't find out what you're fired for. Anything, you know, that's before the, and the strike came on, I remember, in 1919. I was put in as the head of the protection, that is, the police department, you know, that is. They chose one of the term foremen, Clyde Maxwell, to be the, you know, head of it. But Clyde says, Charlie, you're the... I said, what do I know about this thing? Now, wait a minute. I said, you know, well, I'd been working with the police department, safety end of it down at the Sheep and Tube. I became the big end of it. You know what I mean? I couldn't have got killed up there at that time. And I had to set all this stuff out myself. And I had to do it.
You were in charge of the police force.
Yeah,
for the,
that
for
was
Sheep
1919. What there was, and of course, the strike was on. And I said to these fellows at the plant, you know, at the Briar Hill, the 184 and the 142 mill, I said, you fellas are going out? No, we're not going out on strike. Well, they see, that's when McCabin came in here. They pulled them out on strike before they had them organized, tell you the truth. I learned about the inside of a lot of this. So anyway, I became the head of that. And I laughed about it because I used to come home, you know, nobody bothered me, but I didn't like that idea of being in the plant when a strike was on. And they said, Charlie, you don't worry about us. They went out of strike anyway and they weren't going out. The night turn came out, I was nights all the time. Night sergeant, you might remember at that time. So I said, now wait a minute. The fellas were milling around the gates. Well, the day turn went home early, and we don't know what we're going home and we're coming back tomorrow, but they didn't come back. They were out on strike, and I said, what do you put me in there? They said, don't worry about you, you're all right. But anyway, so I became the, you know, I had to lay out this and lay out that. And I'm telling you, I could tell you a lot of things that I did that I don't think anybody's doing today, because I had my own men, you know, my own group, with the addition of these here straw bosses and others, you know, that they put in, you know, during the strike. We used to feed them, you know, 12 o'clock. See, they'd work 6 hours and then they you're home, and then the other turns them in. So my men worked 12 hours, and we were supposed to be paid time and a half after 8 hours, see? So I said to the fellas, I said, well, damn it, I said, if you guys get fed coffee and everything else, my men are going to get fed too. So what I used to do, I used to heist that there milk can I had. You know what a milk can is. And a basket I had of sandwiches. And hiked that on my back, and I went around to all my men. I had about 8 or 10 of them. And I hiked and fed them. My own men, me, Karen, and I were sergeants. I've often laughed about it because Charlie Hogue was, well, you never knew what I was going to do one day for the next.
But anyway. How old were you then?
Huh?
How old were you in 1990?
Well, I was born in 87. Or I'd be
32?
Well, 87 I was born, and it'd be 87. In 1919 I was 30. I was in the draft anyhow, and I was 29. Mm-hmm. And that was, well, let's see, I'd be
32.
Yeah, 32 about that. I had about, I got 9 kids living. But anyway, I would like to know, now that was during 1919, now 37 strike. As I said this to you, The building trades, of course, didn't want no part of it. Well, I kept a lot of things away from them because, after all, John Owens, he was secretary of the mine workers. That's when John Lewis, you know. And he set in to organize the steel workers, and he set in Rhino Capellini and Slovak, and Mayo was in there. There's his son Mayo is in the real estate business here now. But anyway, they came in, and I worked with them, and I went down and protested to the mayor and all of that, and the chief and all of that, and I said, I wanted them, oh, I was burnt up. I was with the communists. The communists was around me, too. You know, I worked with them all. I didn't care what it. But anyway, I can tell you the history of labor. When you'd say, oh, it's a wonder you didn't get killed half the time. Well, I tried to play the game all the way through because I believed in organized labor. And as I said, that in 37, the reason I know, remember that well, I went down to the, I was a Rosenbaum shoe store. Shoe store used to be on the corner of Basin and Federal. It's gone now. But anyway, when I was in there, and when I came out, they said to me, man, you know what's happened? You know, well, you can't get up and down Federal Street. Trucks are crossways and everything. And well, the truck drivers was up the street a ways, and I went up there. And Sidney Frank, he's dead now. He was the mainstream of the main one that really organized this teachers. That is, I had reorganized them two or three times before that, because you never know, you never knew then. But Sidney was working for Zersky Brothers. And he did. He really, yeah, I had to give him credit. But anyway, I said, Sidney, you can't do this here. He says, I know, but they're having trouble over there at Stop 5. That was on the Republic, see? I said, yes, but I says, they're not out on strike, you know, yet. And they said, well, they're having trouble. I said, well, you're an AFL. You're nothing to do with that. So here you're breaking down all your contracts with the AFL, you know, the Teamsters like McKelvey's and Strauss. They did. They broke every bit. I said to you, better get this thing straight around. I know, but he was always out, you know. Of course, he was a Trotsky communist, you know. There were different kinds of Leninites. And I said, well, it just can't be done. And then what happened was, it hadn't had a revolution in McKelvey. If it hadn't been for Lucian, one of the greatest fellows I ever knew, he got them to recognize it was just a mistake they made. So the contracts, you know, they had no business going out because they wasn't in it. You know, I said, well, wait. I said, Ironworks is not out. Briar Hill's not out. The Republic's not out. So why in the world? And that was steelworkers. So we got the thing straightened around anyway, as I said. I was the secretary, and I became secretary just about that time.
Or what specific issues were involved in going out on strike?
Well, the issues of the steelworkers was that, let's see, first, the only union members in steel companies, you know, the old iron works, see the iron, that was the iron, amalgamated iron and tin workers. There was no steel workers then because they didn't make steel much. you know, they started out to make steel, and then, of course, it grew, and steel workers didn't organize, and then McCabe came in to organize them, and as I said, that was 1919, and from then on, why it grew. And finally, I said to the company, I said, you went to work and taught these fellows how to organize with a company representation plan. That broke down later, and I said, in 37, the idea was that these men were, they wasn't recognized because the steelworkers, or rather the companies, thought that they could break them down. You understand? They had learned organization and had learned how to manipulate, and
so wages or hours or things like that weren't a real issue.
Wages and hours and getting really getting together in 37 is when they really reorganized, you might as well say, because I said they had learned before that. And the fact that men were fired and they didn't know what they were fired for, they had no recourse, you know, going back. But finally, as I said, they met and they organized, and Phil Murray broke with John Lewis. Phil Murray was the mine workers, you know, and he really was the mainstay of the steel workers, and they called a strike, you know. And I was up to Wick Park, I remember well with them. I wanted the steel workers organized. And they said to me, my people said, Charlie, we can't. Yeah, I said, wait a minute, why shouldn't they be organized? The more I have to work with, the better off I am. I says, I want them organized. I says, everybody's got a right, if they're going to be fired or they're going to be moved, they want to know what it's all about. So anyway, that was the wages and the right to be recognized and the right for contracts and so forth, which the miners had, of course, you know. And what happened, Phil Murray, he was a mainstay, and he was elected, you know, head of the Steel Workers United. And we had fights between them, and then we had men on both sides of the ice. So in 1941, that was 37. Well, then, as I said, they had the Youngstown Council of of industrial unions and so forth. So they decided they would merge. That was in 50, let's see. We didn't merge for a long time. But finally we merged in 41. I think it was, and locally, you know, each one. And then I became a trustee. Of the group, and I'm still trustee. But anyway, that was wages and everything else of that type, you know. And of course,
what do you think broke the strike? What caused the strike to end?
To end, well. The fact was that what caused it in, they began to recognize, you know, the unions and so forth, the stewards. They were strong enough to, you know. And
no, I mean in 37, the strike went on.
It was on recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, they were organized and so forth. And finally they forced it.
Go ahead.
The recognition of unions was when Phil Murray, he spoke up the Wick Park, I remember, to be recognized, you know, as unions and to be able to negotiate contracts and so forth. That's when the steel workers, Phil Murray, followed that up. That's what it was for.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, they got together and we finally merged into the FLCIO later, you know.
Well, when were the unions finally recognized here in Youngstown?
Well, it was in 41. The steelworkers were recognized, you know. Before that, steelworkers. But the merging of the steelworkers and the AFL was held off for a long time. And Bill Green and them, he was the head of the AFL. And then we didn't get together locally till about 41. We finally decided that we'd have the, merge in Youngstown here in this territory, which we did, and I what we call became secretary, which, I can't think of his name now. He went to Pittsburgh. Sammy Kamens. He was from the steelworker. The Irish, as they call it. So anyway, we merged in. From then on, of course, what our troubles was, I could tell you a lot about troubles, was, of course, the steelworker didn't know what organization was, to tell you the truth. He felt, and of course they took advantage of it. He would work in the mill and then he'd go out and work at build a house, you know what I mean, work at building trades and all of that. Well, he had troubles with that. Naturally, the building trades, wouldn't stand for that, because after all, a steel worker is a steel worker. He's not a carpenter or a bricklayer, because we had troubles with that with the teachers before that. I used to have to batter them around. The idea was that they finally, as I said, it was through Phil Murray and his organization that they became powerful enough to, be recognized and so forth and so on.
In 37, were the Soul Strikers, were they well organized?
They were fairly well, not altogether. They became, I think it was Homestead, where, as I said, that's where really the steelworkers really started being organized. And they were as well organized as they are today, naturally. They were organized, they were in a state of organization, I'd say. Some were in, some were out. And in their meetings, I remember, it seems as though, there was if you got up to talk, you were put down, or you were castigated and so forth. So there was among the members of SELS, they didn't go to meetings and so forth, and let a few, dominated. The business agents, district men, they dominated the thing, and, you were a marked person if you could not talk. So naturally, we were different with the FFL, see. We do things a lot different. Then after we organized, that thing kind of worked out, itself.
Do you think that kept some of the steel workers from siding with the union?
Yeah, it kept a lot of them out because they wanted to make a closed shop out of it, worked the place you had to join. And I don't know, but what the date is, and maybe it's the same way, I couldn't say, because I work with an open shop in the post office, you know, for the, we had it. You could work for the government and not join if you don't want to, it's the same thing today. And I wanted to close shop because I wanted to make a person pay, because there was free riders all the time, you've always had that. But anyway, that's why a lot of the, it was a slow process of working it out, because, as I said, well, the apathy of the steel worker, and then any member who did not realize that if he had something to go with, that is, he had, like, a member of the union, he said, well, what's the use of going down there? Won't let me talk, they shut me up. You know, he didn't realize what it was all about, because after all, he's got to push his own cart. But anyway, they really killed each other, might as well say, you know what I mean. And there was a hard time getting them together. You talk to a fella and he'd say, what's the use of going down? You can't say anything. The officers, they dominate, well, and so forth. So it was a hard thing to get them together. And then another thing is, I always thought, in a steel plant, there is really no trades. You know, if you go from one place to the other with a carpenter, you're a carpenter. You know, not in the steel plants. And they had to work things out so that each job had what he could do and what he couldn't do and so forth. Now, the old amalgamated, as I said, they were really organized. The old amalgamated had the puddlers, as we call them, and the sheet mill men, and the open heart, you know. They were the only three in there in the union under the amalgamated. So it worked out, as I said, that I wanted, I remember I wanted, Tygu was the head of the old amalgamated iron and tin workers, Bill Leonard, and then to meet with the steel, you know, with these men. They called them rabble-rousers and renegades. And I said, meet, because they're going to become a dominant factor in the steel plant. I said, you can't hold it off. There's no use holding. Well, they didn't do it. They said, oh, we're doing that. I said, after all, you get in there and you better work this thing out. And but he didn't do it. And the result was that they organized anyhow. CIO, that was the Committee for Industrial Organization. So, but the fate of the steel worker was like anybody else. He didn't seem to work out what he wanted, although he condemned the idea of being fired. He was fired as many times. I was fired. And I was fired when I left the police force and up there in Briar Hill. And I mean, today I don't know what I was fired for. I tried every way, said, I know what I was fired for. That is, I knew that I didn't get my money. I was in a little trouble because this fellow Hogan, the chief, had a system, you know. If you said anything, why, he knew it. You were spices. But anyway, because I run across that. But anyway, the steel worker was hard to organize because he, with the old amalgamated iron tin worker, the puddler was a puddler no matter where he went. A sheet mill man was a sheet mill man wherever he went. And so was the open heart and sheet mill. Labor, you know, he pulled labors, which of course run the rolls, you know. And they had They had what they call screw down and other things like that. No, but whatever, wherever you went, you couldn't go out and say, well, I must, this or that, they lost. If there were any trades, I don't know where they were. There wasn't no trades. You couldn't go from one place to the other like the old machinists and the others. So anyway, I want them organized because I felt this way that, as I said, I had experience down there when I was safety inspector. And I wore the pilings and the answers and, you know, set up. And I worked for an old post office inspector in Jim, he was down at the sheet and tube, and I had quit the post office in 17, and then they got me back and run the parcel post. But anyway, what happened was with these here organizations, well, the steel worker wanted something, just like they are today. I wanted to know, the other night we talked about that, and I said, Charlie, you know what's the matter with the steel worker today? He's too fat. He's got everything, you know, he got this and he won't, you know. Well, I said, I don't know how they are today, but before they looked on it, the old miners were really organized. You know what I mean, for years and years. And John Lewis was a big man. He was a hard man to deal with, but if it hadn't been for him, he wouldn't have had an organization today. And that's where Phil Murray learned all this. The idea was, the old days, my people, some of my people were miners. And when you went into a town, you walk up the street, some fella would say to you, hey, where you going? He was a guardian. And you're out on the street, you weren't, but you were on mine property. You get the idea? And he said, where are you going? Well, I'm going to see this. Well, now, careful. So it was through the persistence of Bill Murray, as he said, he broke with John Lewis, and that is, he headed up the steelworkers, you know. John Lewis, of course, he dominated, and he tried to nominate him. And there was a feeling there in the AFL between the trades and so forth. Now, John Lewis and he was head of the carpenters. He had a fight one time in the convention, and John Lewis walked out of it. One hit the other, and the other hit him, and so forth. But anyway, he walked out, and if he had, and he walked out, and vowed vengeance on him. Well, what he did do, he put himself out on a limb where the communists wanted to be. Now, that's what he done. He didn't realize it, I don't think, because the Amalgamated Iron Garment Workers, I was talking to Davinsky, a number. Davinsky, they got behind the walking out and all that, but they didn't, weren't going to stamp, they just wanted at that time. But no, the carpenter, I can't think of his name now, but anyway, they dominated, I said, the AFL. So anyway, so he wanted to come back, and he did come back. But for John Lewis, he thought he had something. He had his own trade union, you know, I mean, his own unions, and he was strong enough. But the communists, I worked with them. I knew their tactics, and I...
What were some of the tactics? Could you identify some of the people who were communists locally?
Oh, yes. It was Joe Dallet, was a Leninite. And Sidney Frank was Trotskyite.
Frank was with the Teamsters.
Huh?
Frank was with the Teamsters.
Yeah, Sidney he Frank. Was with the Teamsters, and Joe Dallet was with the steelworkers. And they were mad at me, and not they were mad, but the carpenters and that, when Andy Hubbard was the, and Helen Blumenthal, I worked with these people, and they was, and I said, now wait a minute. How many times I've been in my house all the time? I don't believe in all they did, but the strike of 1924 out in Garfield, New Jersey, Garfield and Lodi and all of them, that was with the textile, that was it. And the German warlord, German industrial, they owned the patents, you know, all of them. So anyway, they had a strike there, you know, they came in here. Mother Bloor was second to, communist. Anyway, she met with me, and we organized a relief committee and so forth, and I was chosen. I was always into all these things. But anyway, they met with me and different things, and I don't know. Joe Dallet was killed in the war in Spain when they had the... Joe didn't need to do that, but Joe was always, he was very well educated. His father was a stockbroker in New York, and he had worked in the steel plant in Pittsburgh, and he saw conditions, you know, so forth. And so he took up that cause, and his wife, she was really a communist, and I can't think of this fellow's name. There's so many names all come together. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they were became national figures. But anyway, they, the communists...
What did they do in the 37 strike here?
They worked. They worked with the steel workers and all of that. And they called it a communistic organization, is what they called it. Well, I said, I don't care what they call them. The idea is they want to be organized. Well, these here communists, they had a way to work. I always worked with them. I never denied them anything of any kind, but I did. As I said, I knew what the other fellow was doing. And I wanted to be where I knew what the other guy that he opposed to me, I wanted to know what he was doing. So I worked both sides of the fence, I would say. But anyway, they called communists, and they did organize. The communists organized the steel workers. Because Lee Pressman, out of Pittsburgh, he was became nationally known as a communist. And you take the Communist Party here.
Gus Hall. Yeah.
Well, Gus was working out. He worked with me and all of them. I know him. But the suspicion was, as I said, the communistic, or whatever you call it, on the steelworkers is what made it slow working. Because you take a Catholic, the Catholic Church took a very strong stand against communism. And what happened was they pinned it on the steelworkers. And the steelworkers had that to deal with because of many steelworkers being Catholics and so forth. And that spread, it held them back a great deal, because I can tell you personal experiences I had with them. But finally, as I said, I don't care what they are, so that we get organized, and I never denied anybody the right. And I said, well, what are you doing with that fellow? He's dangerous. I don't care how dangerous he is. I said, well, Charlie, you want to watch him? Well, he's Chester Media, head of the Youngstown Metropolitan Housing. He said, Charlie, well, I said, well, let's, Chester. I said, after all, do you think I'm not big enough and old enough, strong enough to overcome that. I worked with them all. I said, don't worry about me becoming a communist. I says, I know communists way back more than maybe you know. But anyway, I had the right ears. It's all right. After all, I came from a despotic nation, which was Russia, and that's what brought it about. But anyway, that's what really held back the steelworkers, was the communistic name they put on them. Until finally they overcome that by, you know. And that's what held back the merger between the steelworkers and the council, or rather, investor organization, industrial union, NDF, and OCIO. And finally, it worked out that way. But that's what held back, was the idea they were communists, according to them. Well, that wasn't true. We know they were. I know they were the ones that put John Lewis, when he walked out, having that fight with the head of the Carpenters, and they had it. He walked out bound vengeance on them. He didn't realize that they were around him. You know, the Communists says, here's our chance. So they get him out on a limb, and then they cut the limb off. Now, that's what they did with John Lewis, I know you say they didn't. Mm-hmm. Dave Dubinsky of the Amalgamated Garment Workers, he stayed back, you know, in there. And I had the pleasure of telling Dave that years ago. He was the wise man. He never left the AFL. But as I say, what really was the factors was the steel workers, the steel organizations, and carried on a campaign of, well, as I said, if you were fired for a job, you never could find out why you were fired. Whenever, you know, they wanted. There was only three of them that was really organized, and that was really of their race, and that was the Puddlers, the Sheep Mill, and the Open Heart. The only ones.
So the workers really weren't looking for communist ends. It was
the real issues were
otherwise.
But that was pinned on them on account of religion and so forth, you know. Mm-hmm. They were told they were communists because I could take you right here, a kid now. Now that he was branded, he was Catholic, and he worked for them in the Republic, you know, and I saved him from all a lot of things because I said, no, he doesn't. He can tell you the thing that, you know. And the fellow that was out of it was the communistic thing they put on him, no matter whether it was true or not. Now with me, I organized the Federation of Improvement. End of Indicator course, and then we're in all a lot of things. But the way they worked it was, they didn't condemn me as that there, but they said, now, you don't know how Charlie's going to be. And I had around me, they put me down as something unstable. They wanted me to sue the Vindicator one time because they put a tutorial against me. Well,
when was that?
Oh, that was back in, I had the improvement clubs going then. I was in Esther Hammond. I don't know. I had the improvement clubs going anyway.
What were, could you explain the improvement clubs?
Well, the improvement clubs, we had improvement clubs. A club that was formed for the East Side Improvement Club to get improvements for your ward, or, you know. We had the East Side. We had the North Side. That was formed. And they all were separated, you know. And council met, and council said to me, I remember, they said to me, Charlie, why don't you get these people together so that we know, council knows what to do? And I said, well, it sounded like a good idea. Father Kenny was the main one here that really was a factor here. He's dead and gone now. Because he and I and a few more of them went over the Ocean Bridge and the East High School and the library and all of that. So anyway, they even used religion against
the strikers.
You know what I mean. And we had these clubs going, and the Vindicator, well, that was a factor too. What happened was, as I said, we've always had religion brought in there a lot of time. Well, I had fellas say to me, well, then the Masons, they had their bunch in the Board of Education. I had a fight with them.
Was this in the 1920s, say?
Huh?
Are you talking about 1920s, 1930s?
No, I'm talking about, we organized, and that was in, we organized in, wait a minute. 24, 25, yeah, 1920, really, well, we really started in 1911, no, we had a different clutch. We used to meet at the fire station down here, the East Side Improvement Club and so forth, and that religion was brought in there too, because, well, that was our school, and I never, of course, I was raised, I'm a Protestant, I was a Episcopalian, but I never did draw any lines. We never drawed lines. Those days I've had it were, I've been stoned and everything else. But then years ago, you'd be surprised how they held to the religion. But anyway, these improvement clubs, we had, well, they were all over. There was they'd form to go to Tussle to get something for their end that they thought they should have. So when Bill Buchanan was up at the Lincoln School one time, we used to meet there once, twice a month, and he said, why don't you get together? He was from the Fourth Ward. And Father Kenny says, I don't think it can be done. Well, I said, let's try it. So I went out and I traveled to all these improvement clubs, you know, that we had. And there was a group of them. I'm telling you, boy, there was, you know, more than what you'd think there was. And I really, now I would like to see an improvement club in each ward. So the councilman knows what he's doing. You put him in there and then he don't know anything. So anyway, I organized, and then I was lucky enough, I don't know, I was able to get meetings, places that, you know, I met in a high hotel, the Union League Club, Republican, didn't cost me a dime, you know, and so forth. I met in all of that. And then, of course, we bought the utilities, and then they blasted me. But then, after all, you had to know who you were doing it. They wanted me to join the Chamber of Commerce. And I said, no, we were not going to do that because I want to be in a position where we can approve, you know, if I join them. I only have one book. Then I said, Fred LaBelle, he was the secretary at that time, he'd been now for a long time. But anyway, I said, now Fred, listen, if I join them, I got one book. So you people could all murder me, for that matter. I wouldn't have a chance to go anywhere. If I stay on the outside, and I can either approve, we can either approve what you do or disapprove, one or the other. And that's the way I've done it. And as I said yesterday, I was talking to our retirees up at the church, the government employees, and I said, listen, I learned long ago that you better keep on the ball. We old people don't need to expect the young people to look at us. They've got their troubles. And I said, well, I've learned long ago and I learned still goes with the retirees. Now, you got to push your own cart. If you don't, you're not going to get anywhere. Now, that's all there is to it, because I've lobbied in city council, lobbied in Washington, and I said, for Christ's sake, give that guy something, because he'll be back. If you don't, he'll be back tomorrow. So I said, I learned that that was a persistency, and it goes with the older people. Now, I realize that we in my age, you know, I get a lot of respect, and I enjoy that, I got to say that. I want to say this to you, but the idea is, when I was in politics, too, as I was out of the service, and even while I was in there, you know, I learned this, that if you don't have the respect, why then, anywhere, and they used to, I remember the old days in 1920, they count, well, the first ward, he's okay, second ward, well, the third ward, he's okay, and the second ward, you better go over and talk to that fella, because if you don't know how he's going to jump, well, that was me. I was that way in politics, so how many times I've held them up, and...
Did you ever hold a political office?
No, City Council, I didn't. They wanted me to run for mayor two or three times, but I had to quit the post office to do it, see, under civil service. I could have. I could hold any office where it didn't have any pay to it, in other words. You know, you had to run for this job. I could do that, but when it come to the Hatch Act, so I didn't run for mayor, although I was asked to do it. And I said, well, they didn't even the Vindicator, well, Clinton Jackson could tell you, you know. But I said, no, I'm getting $150 a month as a letter carrier, and I know I got that job. I know I got that job regardless. And if I quit that, because I went through a depression too, you know, when I was out of the service. I learned to work at anything I could work at in order to bring home 50 cents. You know, that was during the Depression. I was out of the service at the time. That was, well, not 37 Depression, but before that, 1919. So I, as I say this to you, I've been knocking around to all of this thing, but I always felt this way. The first thing I learned, as I said to my two oldest boys, the thing I want you to do is to don't do anything that won't bear the light of day, because that is something that will show up just when you don't want it, you know, when it shouldn't. And I've done it so many times, I've seen it happen. I said, and another thing is, get along with the other fellow, no matter how hard he is to get along with. Learn to get along, people, because people had said to me, I don't see how you can get along with that fellow. I said, well, him and I are friends, we're friends and all of that, and I agree, he has ideas, and I have ideas, and then you listen. I'm liable to learn something from him. He may have something that might be all right. How do I know? We're all people. So that's the way I worked it out, as I said, and I've been with some of the biggest ones. I couldn't figure out how I ever came into the thing, because I was a guest with the Chamber of Commerce for 22 years. You know what I mean, when Packard was living. And Charlie Carnegie, I raised that kid, you might as well say. And so many of these boys that have, you know, I carried mail to her. They've got into things and they belong around me, and I enjoy that, because they said, well, Charlie, you ought to be doing that. I said, why? As long as the job is done, I don't care who does it. Now, that's the story. I don't have any jealousies about anything, you know what I mean? Of course, I have been put into things, and I've been given flex, and I was just thinking today, I got a statue from the hobos in America. You you don't know about them. The old hobos years ago, I was formed in 1908 with Jeff Davis and organized. The hobo is a fellow who is a friend of yours, no matter, for the old railroads, you know, were. And he will, a hobo will work. And a bum won't, and a tramp can't. I think that's the way we got it, we got along. But I say, I got over there, I was down in Tiny, Alabama. I was given a big stud down there. I never looked for these things. I never looked for anything that for myself. I've been in all these different movements, and many of them. He never asked for it. I said, listen, I'm in there because I believe in it. And my wife used to give me the devil because I had money laid down right in front of me and I wouldn't take it. You know,
a bribe or just, would that be bribe or you mean just well, wanted to pay you?
No, it wouldn't be a bribe. None of it was bribes. Really, they were just to get me, you know, gifted. But I wouldn't take it. I said, I didn't do that for that. I didn't do it. And listen, you're nuts. Up there, everybody's getting theirs. Why don't you go up and get yours? My wife is the one that, she wanted to kill me. Because, you know, but as I say this to you today, as I said to my two boys, I said, I can walk down the street and I'm not a... It's the greatest feeling to be able to walk down and not worry about somebody putting their hand on your shoulder and say, come with me. Now that's fact. And I went through a lot of things that, well, people have done things and tore the house apart and bombs and everything else. But...
Was that during the time when you were an organizer?
I was an organizer and so forth. And then I became, it seems as though whatever I get into, I seem to take a part in it. I don't ask for these things, but it worries me. It worried me a long time and doesn't worry me yet. You know, in my Labor Congress, we had a paper called the Labor Advocate. And it went by the board because, you know, all those papers at that time don't stand up. And finally the labor union came in from Dayton. And we accepted it, you know, that is for our paper, and we got 10% of the ads. And I'm reading, I'm showing you how people used to look at me. I had 1,500 letters printed recommending, you know, when Mr. Ermel used to go out and sell ads, you know, and so forth. And he was from Dayton and that there. And he said to me one day, he said, you know, I don't understand you. I said, what do you mean? He said, I never run across a fellow like you. I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, I'll tell you. You know, there's letters that had printed. And I would go into a fellow, so many of them. Now, Andy Hubbard, he was a president, they have something against him. But you, I lay that letter down. I said, and they look at it and they said, sign me up. You know. And, well, I haven't even read the letter. I don't need to read the letter. That name, my name. You know, that worried me. It worried me because I said, I can make a mistake. I'm human enough to make them. I've made a lot of them in my day. And I may get behind something that may be no good. How do I know? I'm just as liable to do that any time. So I said, I've got to walk. You know, and that's the way it was. But I was determined to do a lot of things. And as I say this to you today, I can look back over it. And what surprises me is my American servant of liberty. You know, I said more Slavin and Sternberg and more 11, all of them. And we're going to meet Sunday night at Sidney Roberts' house. He's up there at Sidney. Mm-hmm. Sidney and, well, Pat. I had Pat, my new Pat. And I get into these things, and somehow, I don't know why, I don't know whether I can't tell you why, Charlie Ho seems to be the one that gets into these and becomes the fact. I'm an honorary member with a, they won't let me pay any dues with the American Civil Liberties. And that's a fact. And these here, and like you, I said, how did I get in? I didn't have a high school education. But somehow I have been able to do it, and I can't tell you why. But I do say this, the one thing to do is to get along with people, no matter how they are, because you're liable to learn from them something that you really need. Is there anything about this steel strike?
You mentioned the religion as a factor in an earlier period.
What
about nationalities? Huh? Were there any clashes because of people being immigrants, people being from Italian or Slovak?
Well, I found out this in my experience with my improvement clubs and others. And I found out that the immigrant was easier to organize than what the American-born. And they said to me, why is that? Well, I said he was oppressed in the old countries, and he came over here and he found out the amount of freedom, and it wasn't hard for him to step into something, you know, in an organization. I found that to be true. And because, well, that's the way we were organized, you know, in America, you know, King George and so forth. And as I said, no, I said religion was brought in there. The Catholic Church used to frown on that thing an awful lot.
On unions and strikes?
Well,
or on...
it was, they castigate the, you know, on unions. No, but the fact was they believed that the communists, I mean the CIO, was communistic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was
did
true.
Any of the preachers preach in Youngstown at that time against?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they, a lot of, and even I said they're Protestant people. You know what I mean? Oh, yes. So, I've had it being there because I've had people say to me, why do you want that bridge, you know, the Oak Street Bridge we got? Well, that there is, we want it because no Catholic priest wants it, that's all. You know, that was what's in it. And we had clashes back, and not clashes, verbal clashes. And religion was a factor in that too. Communists, you know. They didn't. Well, I never was really an anti-communist, you might well say. I didn't believe in a lot of ideas, but I could see, because I can go back with that a long ways, especially with the despotic gaze and so forth. And they said, how do you know? Well, I said, I looked into things. And then the First World War, I learned a lot about Germany, you know, and I was condemned then a lot of times because Germany, I gave credit for a lot of things was done because they had learned things that we had never, you know, and we do it today, safety first and all of that stuff. I don't know, things, the only thing that I've got today is I sit here, Laura and I talk, people have an apathy. They seem to go for bingo and, you know, other things, all of that lottery. I said, they're all right, but first let's get together on the essential thing that we need. And that is, you know, what our cost of living is. And get that out of that. And then the other comes from that. If you don't get any more money than what it costs you to live, How are you gonna spend this money on this other stuff? Well, we want more than that. We want more than just, say, the cost of living. we want enough that we can help ourselves and educate ourselves and work. And I work with fellows that I've often wondered. Well, I said, how do you get along? Well, I get along with them. After all, I had some of the greatest minds, I thought, you know, especially as I said, in the Chamber of Commerce, I was always, I couldn't figure that out. The only reason I explain some of these things to you is the fact that, like one time down at the hotel, I just said, now don't run away. I did what I've done. They always had room 1200 for a drink before the meetings and so forth and so on, you know, before. And then we go down to the banquet room and so forth. So he said, don't run away, because he said, you know what I've done? I've got the butcher boy to set up a table downstairs along the furnace at the hotel. And we're going to have some of that stuff from upstairs and some eating and all of that. And you and I are going to sit down there and talk. So I sat there and I said, I remember the chief counselor, Chief and Two, come past me. He said, what are you fellas doing? I can't think of his name now. Names don't come to me as fast as they used to. But anyway, we sat there, I remember talking in Ramsdale. Anyway, he said, Charlie, he said, you know, why don't you come in and see me? Chief Counsel, Chief Two. I said, well, I don't know, one of these days. He said, you know, that door is always open. And then here's Packard. Now, Packard was an Army colonel. Had been, you know, very, very neat in his appearance and so forth. But anyway, he said to me, he said, you know, you and I sitting down here, I enjoy this far more than I did that bullshit upstairs. You and I sitting there talking. Now, that's the way we were. And I said, well, I said, and as I said to you, that there's a whole lot of things, but as I said, when this steel strike, the fact is, was the fact that they barreled, or rather, they labeled the steel workers as a communistic organization. And when I explained to you, then, that head of the covers, he and John Lewis, you know, had a fight and walking out, you know, and so forth. That was a building trade. And then John, he thought he had something, and the communists then gathered around him and cut him out on the limb and cut the limb off.
What about the Vindicator during the strike? What do you feel about the Vindicator?
Well, the Vindicator, they didn't go with the steelworkers. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. They didn't hold with them, because they claimed that, like Jimmy Griffin, and Griffin then says the power structure. And I said, listen, who is the power structure? Well, you know who it is, Bill Mogg, and Judge Ford. They're both friends, both dear friends of mine, and so forth and so on. I said, listen, the only way their power structures, you made them that way. You're the one that made them. Well, I didn't go with Al Shipka and all that. I don't go with him today. That is as much as he don't go with me. Him and I, Father Al, I'm this way. I'm not going to be a patsy for him, although I am independent. I don't know what's done me any good or not, but I'm still going anyhow. And as I say this to you, they condemned Jimmy Griffin, and they held it, as I said. They used to put big ads in the paper that if the SEAL was organized, Youngstown would become a ghost town. You get the idea? Well-paid ads and so forth. And I wouldn't, you can't even trust your own people. I wouldn't trust a lot of men in labor. No, I'm not kidding you, because they condemned me. I was condemned right away. Sidney Frank and all of them. And I said, well, you see, I had the men from the La Follette Committee was formed, you know, to investigate labor years ago. And Shapiro and another fellow used to come here, and I gave him, you know, what I knew about things. And Ruggleworth, my name in the hearings, and the back to work movement, see, because they had ads in their coupon where you could sign back to work. Somebody wrote my name on one of them back to work movements. And of course, when this hearing came out and printed, why, my name showed up. Well, I didn't know anything about it. And I'm down there in East Federal Street, and Sidney Frank, and what's his name? And them came to me and said, Charlie, I said, what are you talking about? You know, he had got, and they said they saw my name. And I said, wait a minute. My name, well, I never knew nothing about it. Well, now you will just, you resign and cover up all of that. I said, you're not covering up for me. Brother, I said, here I am among my own people. And you want me to do that? No, you don't. I'm going to fight this thing back. So I got a hold of Muggleworth. He said, well, the name appeared in there. I don't know how we're going to get it out. This was from Washington. And I said, I couldn't, you didn't trust your own people. You know what I mean. Here they wanted me to just pass out and so forth. Well, I don't do those things. Oh, no. I said, I'll fight that. And I did. As I said, I went and was going to sue the pastor of the Plymouth, the church on the corner of Lincoln Avenue, and that he was ahead of the. That's how it came in there.
The back to work movement?
Huh?
The back to work movement?
Yeah.
Talking about?
Well, he was ahead of the committee of the Chamber of Commerce. And I said, I have a notion to sue. He said, I'd never seen it. I said, I know about who put it in there. And Red Johnson has probably put it in, because he was trying to form company unions against our, you know, mm-hmm. against our, because I was the first dreamer that the Teamsters ever had. Mm-hmm.
Did you do any organizing of the steel strike itself? Did you work with the picket lines
with them,
and
yeah,
so forth?
I worked with them, as I said. I told you that I worked with them because I helped them wherever I could, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't an organizer for them, no. Mm-hmm. But Jimmy Griffin and them, I remember I was talking. I remember Jimmy Griffin and Shipman, and I said, now listen, I'll tell you what. You know what you're going to do, Jim and them? You're going to become just like the FFL. You say that they, all they do is fix up a little here and a little there. I said, you're going to become the same thing. I said, you're in the high day of organizing and all that, you're going to do this, and you're going to have low dues and all that. Well, that isn't so. I said, as the thing goes on, you're going to add on. But you know, the dues in the steel workers are as low as what they were. They were going to have $1 a month and all of that. I said, that can happen in the beginning, you know. But anyway, in organizing, I helped them, because when Creighton and what's his name, they were ahead of the union after the trust gone, you know.